From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Barbara Slavin, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council and Washington Correspondent for Al Monitor. Joining me on the show this week are David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington Columnist for The Economist, and Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington, D.C. And here are the issues. As a landmark nuclear deal went into effect, Iran freed five jailed Americans in return for clemency for seven Iranians convicted of violating U.S. sanctions. New satellite imagery revealed that the group that calls itself the Islamic State has destroyed the oldest Christian church in Iraq, which had stood on a hill near Mosul for 1,400 years. At the same time, the United Nations released a study reporting the deaths of nearly 20,000 Iraqis since ISIS began rampaging through northwestern Iraq in 2014. In Pakistan, Taliban militants killed more than 20 people, most of them students and teachers, at a university near Peshawar. It was the deadliest attack against civilians in more than a year. And finally, in the United States, former vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin went rogue and endorsed Republican frontrunner Donald Trump. The endorsement could sway some Tea Party voters in Iowa and New Hampshire, who are soon to begin the actual process of choosing who will run for president this year. Gentlemen, let's start with Iran. There are still reverberations coming from this deal, which was implemented recently, and from the prisoner swap that also took place. Michael, maybe let me start with you. Why are so many people in this country, particularly Republicans, so annoyed that we got five Americans who'd been jailed in Iran home?
Well, it's very interesting in the echo chamber of American presidential politics how a series of events can be viewed so differently by two different sets of people. Of course, if you are a Democrat or for the Obama administration, you see this as a great success, diplomatically, a success for potentially creating a lasting relationship or signs of an increasingly better relationship between the two countries. But the Republicans, of course, see this as weakness and capitulation, which has been the narrative the entire time the Obama administration has been in effect. So that's certainly not going to change by any one series of events. I think the most stunning part of this is sort of the quickly overlapping things that happened with Iran. All of these things happen from time to time with a nuclear deal or a pact or prisoner changes or things like that, but the way they sort of came together so quickly, it was very interesting to watch how those things affected different people. You had Ted Cruz saying that he would go to war immediately after seeing U.S. sailors being detained, and within 24 hours they were done, and we had another deal, and then sanctions were imposed 24 hours after that, new sanctions. Yeah. It was all just a stunning and fascinating series of events to watch so quickly, but again, the interesting part from an American political perspective is that difference between the two parties and how they see the very same set of events.
Yeah, David, it was really breathtaking for someone who has followed Iran for a long time to see these events one after another. Joe Cirincione of the Plowshares Fund called it a trifecta. you know, the nuclear deal, the prisoner exchange, and I'm trying to remember what the third would be.
Well, Michael referred to the 24-hour detention
of the... Oh, and the sanctions too.
Well, no, so we had for 24 hours, let's not forget, we had some American sailors detained by the Revolutionary Guard Navy because there's these disputed waterways.
Yeah, well, they strayed into the Iranian waters.
And they strayed in these patrol boats into Iranian waters. They were detained for 24 hours. I mean, I think what Michael's putting his finger on when he talks about the difference in perception between Democrats and Republicans is really this boils down to, I mean, in part it's election year, so people are being opportunistic. They're taking the chance to advance their narrative that President Obama is the worst foreign policy president ever. But it's also just a fundamental question of trust because, of course, prisoner swaps, every president has done them. Reagan did them. You know, the Bushes did them. It's
the Israelis.
The Israelis do it with
1,000 prisoners for one Israeli soldier.
And so this is something that always causes a bit of heartburn because, you know, there is a risk that you're, in some cases, you know, swapping them for people you'd rather hold on to. I don't think that's the case in this instance, but sometimes you are letting people go you'd rather not. But it was a great Cold War tradition. Remember all the Bridge of Spies, the new Spielberg film, with people being swapped between the Soviet Union and America. But I think what you have clearly seen with this Iran deal is, as Michael says, an absolute conviction on the Republican side that President Obama is turning Iran into an ally. We saw this very interesting language from one of the presidential contenders who's running as kind of perhaps the most hawkish on foreign policy, Senator Marco Rubio of Florida. And he has this line now, why are we treating Iran like an ally? Why does President Obama think Iran is an ally? And you, I mean, you know the Iran dossier well, Barbara, you may say that's absolute nonsense. They don't think Iran is an ally. But the problem is a lot of Americans hear that and it makes sense to them. It rings true. It chimes with their pre-existing belief of this president in his last year in office. And there is just a lot of people in this country who don't trust anything that this administration does.
Yeah, which, you know, poses the question, Michael, of whether the nuclear deal and so on will survive the Obama administration. It's now international law. It's been blessed by a UN Security Council resolution. It's been embraced by the entire international community. So my own view is that despite what the Republicans say now in the heat of a presidential campaign, if Iran is abiding by this deal, it actually will go on. But I think a bigger question is whether these extraordinary channels that have developed between the United States and Iran will persist. John Kerry has spoken on the telephone more to the Iranian foreign minister, Javad Zarif, than any other foreign minister, certainly since this year began. So there is a real question in my mind about whether, you know, even if it's Hillary Clinton, they can maintain these kinds of bridges with the Iranians.
It is interesting to know whether this will persist. And I always say, you know, to have a deal, you have two persons shaking hands. And who are you shaking hands with, really, in Iran right now? Is it the political side or is it the cultural side? And political come and go, even in Iran. But there's a culture that needs to be contended with for a long-term relationship. And not sure how well we can ever shake hands with that type of fundamentalism that leads to the rogue state feeling that people have about Iran.
I think one of the things that's most depressing about the way that Iran is sort of discussed here in politics is that very few people on the Republican side are willing to accept that there are factions in Iran. So, you know, we saw that this week, that the prisoner transfer almost didn't happen because at the last minute, some of the hardline forces in Iran wanted to hold on to the wife and the mother of Jason Rezaian, the Washington Post reporter who was held by it for more than a year with, you know, absolutely outrageously held for more than a year. And at the last minute, the hardliners nearly derailed the whole thing. And it was the two foreign ministers who managed to sort it out. But on the Republican side here and on the conservative side here, there's a sort of impatience with the idea that there are good and bad people in Iran, that there are sort of hardliners and less hardliners. You know, you have Republicans on record saying they're all hardliners.
Yeah.
It's monolithic. And I think that's a fairly, as you say, as we look forward to the future, that's pretty worrying.
Yeah, I think one thing that's been interesting to watch, I mean, when the nuclear deal was reached, there were huge complaints on the Republican side. Well, but our prisoners are still there. Now, the prisoners are out, with the exception of one, I should say, Siamak Namazi, who remains held. And now they say, well, we gave up too much, and it was appeasement. You know, so to some extent, these people simply, you know, can't be placated. Another thought that has popped up on Twitter, and I've gotten into some Twitter fights with folks is, well, you said this was going to empower the moderates in Iran, and now we see that they're disqualifying candidates, reformist candidates, for their parliamentary elections. Things like this take time to play out, you know? We don't know what the impact is going to be on Iran domestically. We don't know what the impact is going to be on Iran's activities in the region yet. And I would urge people just to take a deep breath and wait a while and see, you know, because I think we will see some positive aspects over time, but it will take a while. And with that, let's take a short break. We'll be right back with more issues in the news.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, the host for Jazz America, where each week we give you the best of jazz past and present and conversation with the music makers. You can hear the program online at voanews.com and on the air on VOA each Saturday and Sunday at 13 hours Universal Time. Join me for Jazz America and help me celebrate the greatness of a century of jazz. Listen at 13 hours Universal Time, Saturdays and Sundays, on voanews.com and the Voice of America.
Welcome back to Issues in the News on VOA. I'm Barbara Slavin with Michael Williams and David Rennie. We were talking about Iran, but let's move next door. Very, very disturbing story. David, it's actually an old story, but we're only now finding out about it because of the satellite photos. An ancient, the oldest Christian monastery in Iraq, destroyed by ISIS, according to new satellite imagery.
That's right, that's right. I think it's the Associated Press, I think, commissioned these satellite images. So we had this ancient monastery going back 1,400 years near the Iraqi city of Mosul, And it survived the Saddam Hussein era because it was inside a military base, I think an air base. It wasn't in fantastic shape, but, you know, it was essentially there. And when the Americans occupied Iraq, they started restorations. They put a roof over it. And I think, in fact, some American military chaplains even held services there. So it was a kind of living church. The new satellite imagery shows that it has been destroyed. There's just kind of dust and rubble there. This shouldn't be a surprise in some ways. Islamic State has made it absolutely clear that they do not see any right for Christians to exist on their territory. But this is, you know, the fact that the monastery was 1,400 years old tells you something about how ancient and how deep the roots of Christianity are in Iraq. And actually, although Saddam Hussein was, you know, a brutal man who nobody should mourn, his own foreign minister, Tariq Aziz, was a Christian. So, you know, there was a sense that Christians could survive. And, I mean, the numbers are horrendous. I think there were nearly 1.5 million Christians in Iraq before Islamic State got a hold. There are now 300,000 Christians left in Iraq. Some of them have fled. Some of them have been killed. There was a Chaldean Christian bishop interviewed on American radio this week who said it is essentially a genocide. That's a much overused word. But, you know, when someone like that from Iraq uses that word, you can see what he means. You can see how he feels that.
Yeah, it's. I mean, when you think of the long history of the Middle East, you know, all the various political movements and ideological movements, and Christians remained, Michael, through all of that period, and now just in the last couple of years, they really are being completely pushed out of the region.
History expert at Cornell University, I believe his name is Sturt Manning, said that it would be pathetic if it wasn't so sad. It's just a symbol of what ISIS really stands for. You know, as you say, do you point back to the roots and the history of this and how many civilizations have actually attacked that particular symbol at some point or another, St. Elijah's, I believe it's called, and then at other points it's been restored. And always there's been a recognition that this is a part of human history, a part of an anchor point where we can go say we've come this far from this particular point. And it just points to this particular psychopathic behavior of a desire to disaffect oneself from the rest of humanity. I think it's just
and destroy history. Destroy the history.
And it's also, I mean, I'm not Muslim, I'm not an Islamic theologian, but, you know, I've worked in many Muslim countries, and people have always told me, including in places like, you know, the north of Afghanistan in rural areas where people are not exactly liberal Muslims, they have always said, you know, there are people of the book. If you're Muslim, Christian, or Jewish, we all come from the same tradition, you know, Abrahamic faith. You know, we're all, you know, in some ways, cousins who can respect each other's differences. There's, you know, it's never been axiomatic in Islam that Christians could not coexist with Muslims. But the Islamic State, you know, has hijacked this religion to create this kind of millenarian kind of death cult.
Yeah. You know, if we look at, of course, the causes of this, we have to go back to the 2003 U.S. invasion, which swept away Saddam Hussein, who, as David pointed out, had a Christian foreign minister and was actually, to the extent he was liked by anybody, I suppose, was liked by the Christian community. You know, this has set in train a whole series of events that we have been witnessing. And now there's a study coming that's come out from the United Nations with a horrendous figure. I mean, if you think that, what, something like 100,000 or more died after the U.S. invasion of Iraq, now we see that 20,000 apparently have died just since ISIS began rampaging through Iraq in 2014. This is yet another country that is being destroyed in the Middle East.
The brutality is stunning in scope. I believe it's a total of 55,000 total casualties when you include injuries, 3.2 million displaced. And just to go back for a second and talk about the destruction of the historic site, it's something that's a standard warfare tactic to destroy sites like this, psychological warfare. But the hypocrisy in the ISIS movement is that they're actually saving certain antiquities and selling them to fund their movement. So they recognize the value of some of these things while destroying others. Yeah. But to go to the death and destruction that's gone on, it's the slavery of children that we, you know, unfortunately we talk about from time to time here, of women being forced into sexual slavery. It is a brutal, brutal, brutal regime. And you hear stories from day to day about this, but when you see a report that gathers and compiles these statistics, we get the true scope of it, and you still don't feel the personal human pain that those are responsible for.
Just one thing I would slightly, I mean, from my point of view, you can clearly say that the American-led invasion of Iraq in 2003 unleashed forces, and some of those forces are providing some of the malevolent energy for what is happening here. I don't think if the Americans had not invaded Iraq, if that mistake had not been made, I'm not sure you could say Islamic State or something like it would not exist. I think that these forces are also driven by socioeconomics, the sheer number of young people with no hope, with no opportunity, with no employment. And there were precursors, you know, Al-Qaeda, the ancestors.
Well, actually, not in Iraq.
But, you know, the ancestors, this, you know, ISIS is an offshoot of Al-Qaeda sort of ideology. It's in a more extreme version.
Yes, but married to Saddam Hussein's former
intelligence people. these extreme forces were there. And the Middle East has been poised for this kind of social upheaval and unrest in lots of ways for a long time. So, I absolutely accept that, you know, my own magazine, we endorsed the invasion of Iraq in 2003. That was a mistake. But I don't think you can say that it was the thing that caused all of this. I think it is the energy unleashed is at work. But I think that, you know, this region would not be a peaceful kind of paradise had that invasion not taken place.
I have to agree with that. It's a powder keg, and it's just more heavily armed to the teeth than it ever has been. And you also have this proxy war now that's going on between, you know, the Sunnis in Saudi Arabia, the Shia in Iran. There's no way to say exactly what would have happened, but for sure the circumstances, the tender for a fire, has been there for a long, long time.
Okay, time for another break. We'll be right back with more issues in the news.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Welcome back. I'm Barbara Slavin with David Rennie and Michael Williams. We were talking, Michael, about Sunni versus Shia. It's another country that's facing those strains, but also just terrible internal tensions of its own, and that's Pakistan. Things had been looking a little bit more stable for a while, but now we have yet another horrendous attack by their local Taliban on a university campus, the Bacha Khan University in Charsada, 20 miles from Peshawar. Apparently, these Taliban were based in Afghanistan, or at least their leaders based in Afghanistan, and now have carried out these attacks. It has been the other way around. Is there anything that anyone can do to stop this?
That's a very good question. I think that Pakistan had certainly taken steps after, I guess, 14 months ago it was, there was another attack in Peshawar where 150 people were killed, and the Pakistani government cracked down, and I believe there were some 300 executions of supposed perpetrators of this or planners of this type of movement that were taken care of. But clearly, it's how many people do you need to kill to bring about the end of a movement? And this Taliban movement, it's not a border thing. It goes across borders between Pakistan and Afghanistan. Very difficult. The same person who took credit, I believe it's Omar Mansour, Khalifa Omar Mansour, took credit for organizing both attacks. How do you stop a movement? We'll see. That's a question that's hanging in the air all over the world, isn't it?
And yeah. Michael's absolutely right to mention that attack 14 months ago, because if you were going to be an optimist 14 months ago, that awful, awful attack had the seeds of persuading the Pakistani military and security apparatus, the kind of deep state that controls so much of Pakistan, to really get tough with the Taliban, because tragically, 14 months ago, that was an attack on a military academy and a lot of the dead with the children of military officers. So that was a direct strike on the army. And one of the problems, one of the reasons that border between Pakistan and Afghanistan has been so sort of porous and turbulent for so long, is that for far too long, particularly the military intelligence inter-services in Pakistan, was essentially enabling the Taliban. They were their protectors and they were their enablers because it suited them, partly because there's a lot of Islamists in the Pakistani military now and in intelligence, but also because it was a way of destabilizing the region, keeping India destabilized, having forces to harry and harass the Indians. So they created, to some extent, this monster. There was a sense that they had realized that this monster was now out of control. So as Michael says, they reintroduced the death penalty, having had a moratorium. But, you know, as you say, you can't just kill your way to eliminating these fanatics. And if you want to depress yourself still further, let's remember that the reason that Pakistan is a very scary place to have this much unrest and chaos is it's got nuclear weapons.
Nuclear.
Yeah.
And so this is, you know, and I think America, you know, which has provided a lot of money and military aid over the years with a great deal of disquiet and distaste for who they were providing it to, you know, we don't have a lot of good options in that region.
Yeah, no, indeed. And obviously a peace agreement, though, in Afghanistan could perhaps help. But It's on both sides of the border and, you know, rugged terrain, et cetera. But the choice of target, I mean, to kill the future of the country, that's really what they're trying to do by murdering students and
teachers.
They
certainly send messages that way. That's what they do.
But let's turn to our own very interesting politics, gentlemen. I made myself watch it. I watched Sarah Palin, the former vice presidential candidate, endorse Donald Trump, who is the front runner for the Republican nomination for president. And it was a surreal experience, I must say. She has a way of speaking that is esoteric, shall we say, idiosyncratic? I don't know what the word is. And some of the language, I mean, she invented a word, coined a word.
The squirmish.
Yes, a squirmish. She said that the Middle East was full of squirmishes. And all I could think was maybe she can see those squirmishes from her house in Alaska, do you think? Squirm plus skirmish, I guess. Actually, I kind of like it, but... Michael, what do you make of this endorsement? Is it just about Sarah Palin trying to get more publicity for herself? Will it do Donald Trump any good? Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So there, I did not watch it. I read the transcript, and that was enough for me. And look, the other day I was driving around Washington, D.C., and I saw a car with two bumper stickers on it. One was Real Men Love Jesus, and the other one was Trump for America. And I spent the next 5 miles trying to reconcile those two things in my mind. And I think that Sarah Palin does is sort of speak to that person somehow in the evangelical mind, you know, that, you know, we love Jesus, but we want to be King David, you know. And I think that that Donald Trump is King David. He's that sort of charismatic, you know, slightly flawed, but yeah, I'd follow him into the valley of death type of guy. The presidential elections every 4 years has become the most expensive, best financed, best publicized kabuki theater in the world. And there's no way that Sarah Palin was going to sit this one out. So you knew she was going to come in at some point. Yeah. Didn't know who for necessarily.
Why so early?
Well, we're about to discover something very important about this soap opera of Donald Trump. February the 1st is the first actual contest with real people casting real votes in a caucus in Iowa. The first of the many contests that will choose a candidate for each party to go into the election. And what we don't know at the moment is Donald Trump does really well in terms of opinion polls. He does really well in terms of packing rallies with cheering supporters. The last best hope of the establishment, the old kind of power brokers in the Republican Party, is that he has fans, not voters. That actually these people are going along to see the spectacle, but they won't turn out. And in particular, Iowa matters. Not because Iowa tends to pick the eventual winner, because Iowa is a 95% white farm state with lots of evangelicals, so it tends to pick a very right-wing candidate. But Iowa matters because it's the first time that people actually come out and cast a vote. And also, it's a caucus, which is not just a standard election where you put pieces of paper in a box like a normal election. You actually have to spend hours and hours and hours in front of your neighbors kind of arguing for your candidate to some extent. So it's embarrassing. It's hard work. It's a big commitment. And remember that it's snowing. It's below zero there. So there's a whole sort of hope that maybe, maybe Donald Trump isn't as successful as we think. And come those first votes, actually, he will not win in Iowa and the wind will be knocked out of his sails. So the reason we saw Sarah Palin, this figure from the past, who was such a big populist figure in the 2008 elections, coming now, was that she is trying to provide Trump with a kind of endorsement that he's a proper conservative, that some of the attacks on him at the moment, that he's not a proper conservative, that he's a New York billionaire, that he's actually a fake conservative. She was providing him with that kind of cover.
Street cred, we
would call
it.
And right now, it's all about those first contests in Iowa and then a few days later in New Hampshire. And we will find out in the next 2 or 3 weeks. We will either be sitting here saying, well, that was Trump. That was fun while it lasted. Or, oh my goodness, he just did really well in Iowa and New Hampshire, and now, you know, all bets are off.
Yeah, it was fascinating. I mean, the reason you need to watch it, Michael, is because the expression on Trump's face, while Sarah Palin went through this 20-minute, whatever you want to call it, stream of consciousness, is really rich. You can see, frankly, that he's not used to associating with people like Sarah Palin.
Right.
He's used to associating with fellow billionaires and, you know, models from Eastern Europe and whatnot. Not this kind of person who is a literal gun-toting, you know, Mama from Alaska. And so I highly recommend you watching it. I don't know that it will make that much of a difference, but, you know, it's certainly entertaining. Well, that's all the time we have. Joining us today were David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist, and Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington. The program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineers were Jackson Witt and Linus Rimkus. I'm Barbara Slavin, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor. Thanks for listening.